Good morning. French President Emmanuel Macron says 26 countries are ready to send troops to Ukraine on land, air, or sea once a peace deal with Russia is reached. What's Russia's response? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Marco Rubio is Secretary of State and Acting National Security Advisor and Acting Archivist of the United States. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Why does President Trump like giving people multiple jobs at the same time? Also, what to take away from the major tech CEO's dinner at the White House yesterday. And in this week's StoryCorps, the first black woman to design cars for Ford remembers her inspiration, her father. It's Friday, September 5th. On this day in 1976, it was time to play the music and light the lights as The Muppet Show debuted. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Labor Department provides an update on the job market this morning. NPR's Scott Horsley reports it comes amid signs of a marked slowdown in the pace of hiring.
For the first time in more than 4 years, there are more people looking for work than there are job openings in the U.S. Many consumers say they're cautious about spending money, and many employers are cautious about hiring as a result. Concern about a softening job market could lead the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates later this month. The Fed's been holding its benchmark rate steady since December as it keeps a wary eye on stubborn inflation. The August report is expected to show a continued drop in the number of federal government jobs. President Trump abruptly fired the Labor Department official who oversees the report after disappointing jobs numbers last month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has told a Senate committee that the country's major medical and scientific groups cannot be trusted. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports Kennedy, an anti-vaccine activist, has clashed with these groups for years.
Since being sworn in as the country's top health official, Secretary Kennedy has canceled millions of dollars for vaccine research, had his own CDC director fired, and limited the FDA approval for the latest COVID-19 booster. In the Senate Finance Committee hearing, Kennedy explained his theory for why groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics have been critical of these moves.
I think the American Academy of Pediatrics is gravely conflicted. They get their biggest contributors are the four largest vaccine makers.
The AAP said that was false and misleading, that less than 4% of their revenue comes from industry, and that pediatricians support vaccines because they are safe and they work to protect children's health. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
A bipartisan effort is still underway to take a vote in the House. It's to force the release of all criminal files on late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Some women who accused him of sex trafficking gathered this week at the Capitol to call on lawmakers to act. One survivor, Liz Stein, says others who have accused Epstein want to make sure that authorities focus on the alleged crimes and not on the politics of the case.
What we're definitely willing to do is to help facilitate justice in whatever ways that we can. But I think that the public is very hung up on this list of names that really just does not exist.
She spoke to NPR and WBUR's Here and Now. President Trump is expected to sign an executive order today. NPR has learned that it will give the Defense Department a new name, the Department of War. A fact sheet seen by NPR shows that the order will let the agency use the Department of War as a secondary title. This title was used by the U.S. until the 1940s. This is NPR. Ukraine has proposed a format for protecting its skies, and this has been presented to the United States as well. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders have held their next meeting of what's called the Coalition of the Willing. NPR's Polina Litvinova reports members of this group have now talked with President Trump.
President Zelensky wrote on X that the main topic of his conversation with President Trump was how to push the situation toward real peace. Protection of Ukrainian skies, in Zelensky's opinion, is one of the key priorities, as are security guarantees. This summit of the Coalition of the Willing followed the meeting of European leaders, Ukraine's president and President Trump, in the White House in mid-August. Then Zelensky agreed to meet with Russian leader Vladimir Putin for direct talks, but it never happened. Putin suggested Zelensky come to Moscow for the negotiations, but so far the Ukrainian leader has declined. Полина Литвинова, NPR News, Киев.
The Trump administration is suing a California utility over a deadly wildfire last January in the Los Angeles area. At least 19 people were killed in the Eaton Fire. Federal prosecutors say that utility Southern California Edison failed to safely maintain its equipment. Some say sparks from a piece of electrical equipment triggered the blaze. Southern California Edison has acknowledged only that its equipment may have been involved. The Trump administration is seeking to recoup tens of millions of dollars in costs. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
Shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country.
Whoever thought a founding father would make a Broadway sensation? Writer and actor Lin-Manuel Miranda did. Miranda's hip-hop-influenced Broadway play and soundtrack, Hamilton, redefined what a musical could be. In 2016, Miranda and Questlove of the group The Roots put their heads together for a Hamilton soundtrack reboot, not performed by the Broadway cast, but by a cherry-picked roster of musical talents. Sometime later, a Minneapolis hip-hop artist got a call. She was Dessa. She'd made a name working with the influential music collective Doomtree and with her own solo projects. Lin-Manuel Miranda wanted Dessa to produce a track for the Hamilton spinoff album, but she only had 6 days. The highly anticipated Hamilton mixtape was released December 2nd, 2016, with contributions from Alicia Keys, Sia, Usher, The Roots, Chance the Rapper, and Dessa.
Congratulations. You've redefined your legacy.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump will sign an executive order later today to bring back a name for the Defense Department that has not been used in more than 70 years, the Department of War. We'll have more on that in a few minutes.
First, though, Europe has finalized a strategy to guarantee peace and security in Ukraine once the war comes to an end.
The plan, which would include troops on the ground, was announced Thursday at a summit in Paris. It has yet to be guaranteed by the U.S., but already early this morning, Russian President Vladimir Putin has offered his reaction.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley is in Paris. So, Eleanor, what did the Europeans announce?
Well, 35 countries got together physically here and by video link. Not only European, the group is known as the Coalition of the Willing. It includes Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and Canada. And they say they are ready to commit to Ukraine's security and have concrete plans for it. Here's French President Emmanuel Macron, who spoke after the meeting, standing alongside Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Let's listen.
Nous avons aujourd'hui 26 pays qui formellement se sont
engagés. He said we have 26 countries formally committed to deploying a reassurance force of troops in Ukraine to be physically present on land, air, or sea to guarantee peace the day it is declared. Now, Macron said he could not give any details, but he said they would be ready. And for anyone who thinks this is just more talk, Macron reminded everyone of how far this group has come. They first came together last February in despair, really, when it became very clear that the U.S. under President Trump was going to be completely different on Ukraine than the Biden administration. Back then, Macron said only 2 countries were ready to commit troops.
What about the United States? Will it play a role in this coalition?
Well, hopefully, yes. Macron and Zelensky also spoke with President Trump after the meeting. They said they spoke to him for an hour and a half, and they said the U.S. role would be determined in the coming days. Europeans definitely are counting on the U.S. to be there. Macron claimed the U.S. is fully on board, and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff was in Paris at the meeting, but clearly there are doubts how the U.S. will contribute or even if. And I spoke with Martin Kinsé, who is the director of the Paris office of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and he says it's hard to see a U.S. backstop providing major guarantees.
Now, the backstop could be at least some sort of intelligence and logistical support. And there you could see the U.S. participating in providing capabilities that Europeans do not have, without obviously sending any troops to Ukraine or officially guaranteeing the security of those European troops.
Okay, but how has President Putin reacted to the announcement?
Right. Well, President Putin has been in China over recent days, joining huge celebrations on the end of World War II with allies China and North Korea. This is the new multipolar world on display that's against U.S. dominance. And this morning, Putin said that, quote, any foreign troops in Ukraine would be a legitimate target for Russian forces. It's not surprising. And it's why Macron said that the main pillar of Ukraine's post-war security is actually a strong Ukrainian army. He said they will not accept any restrictions on the size and shape of Ukraine's forces in the future.
So what if Vladimir Putin, Eleanor, just does not agree to a peace deal?
Exactly, and that's what we've been seeing. And Macron admitted that Putin thinks he's winning, so he doesn't want to stop the war. But he emphasized that Russia has suffered more than 1 million casualties for barely 20% of Ukrainian territory. And Macron said there will be new economic sanctions in coordination with the U.S. if Russia continues to refuse to end its war. And President Trump also spoke about that. He didn't mention sanctions, but he said that the Europeans need to stop buying any Russian oil.
All right, that's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to turn next to Hanna Schellest for a take on this from Ukraine. She followed the meeting from Odessa. She's the director of security programs of the Foreign Policy Council's Ukrainian PRISM think tank, and she's with us now. Good morning, Ms. Schellest. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning.
What did you hear from this meeting that would help Ukraine most in this ongoing war?
First of all, it's definitely the unity of our European partners. That's what Russia is trying to destroy as much as possible. And the resolution finally to speak about the certain boots on the ground, but also on sea. And here the U.S. position is very important for everybody. First of all, not only in terms of capabilities of the weapons, but the unity, transatlantic unity of the support that Russia is trying to destroy as much as possible. But everybody understands that it is intermediary meeting. It is really a huge step after February, but nobody's looking at it as the final or the decisions that really would be like these. Everybody mm-hmm. understands that a lot of work should be done to make it practical.
Mm-hmm. So we just heard that the United States part in this plan has not been determined yet. Now, you know, it's been reported that Germany is waiting for the U.S. to give details about its plans before it says what Germany will do. Are you concerned that this is indicative of a broader issue where, other leaders are going to wait for somebody else to commit first?
We had this problem previously, if we would remember the tank coalition, for example. But mm-hmm. here I think that the decision is much more practical. A lot of the U.S. forces are based at the Germany territory. So definitely Germany would like to understand the involvement of these forces, for example, mm. or their capabilities. The second is that the air defense capabilities, they dependent on the U.S. Airplanes that are patrolling the territories or from the satellites that deliver the intelligence information. So here to make a real plan, you need to understand, is the United States involved or not?
And what do you see as the most likely role that the U.S. would take on?
You know, honestly, with all the statements that from the Ministry of Defense we are coming to the Ministry of War, first of all, we would like to see the probably end of all these 2 weeks promises for the Russian president. Hmm. Because we see how the Russian president now is really bullying the U.S. side with all the statements, everything what been agreed in Alaska or other meetings, telephone calls. He's now just telling, oh, no, I never promised anything like this. And he's waiting what will be the reaction of the United States. So we definitely now see the game of the political wills and manipulations, especially from the Russian side. And probably from the United States, everybody would like to see clarity in terms of their approach towards Russia.
Well, just so I understand, you're saying that what you said, these two-week promises, you feel that the United States, that the Trump administration sort of keeps kicking the can down the road and giving Russia more time. Is that what I hear you saying? That you just like to see a definitive answer about what the U.S.'s role is going to be. Is that what you're saying?
It's not only my saying, but we are monitoring the Russian channels and we see the reaction from the Russian side. And we see that the last months they're really mocking these 2 weeks in different TV shows, for example, or in the social networks from the different opinion makers. And they are saying like, oh, don't worry, yet one call and we receive additional 2 weeks or 2 months without the new sanctions. We just need to keep promising.
Yes.
So de facto, we see that it is really read like these by the opponents in Moscow.
So after this demonstration of solidarity from European leaders, President Putin said foreign troops in Ukraine would be a legitimate target for Russian forces. How do you hear that?
Easily, as the element of deterrence. He understands that only the NATO countries' forces at the Ukrainian territory can be the real guarantee, in addition to the strong Ukraine armed forces, because he understands that it is not something he would like to risk. So he needs to do as much as possible to prevent their deployment, because he feels that in this case he can attack further as soon as he needs it, without any evidences or the witness for this, or support for Ukraine.
So before we let you go, just about 30 seconds left here. We've been here before. As you noted, Europe and the U.S. have made promises to Ukraine, yet the war continues. What's your sense of how Ukrainians are experiencing this back and forth in this moment?
I would say that because we are with this for the last year with both administrations, that's why Ukrainians are just saying that, yeah, we're really thankful for the U.S. people, first of all, to all that support that we are receiving. But the real security guarantees is just Ukrainian armed forces and the strong position of the society in this war. So that's probably this determination is the main logic and the main sentiment in the Ukrainian society. Okay. Because people understand it's not the fight for territories, it's fight for people.
That's Hanna Shelest. She's the director of security programs of the Foreign Policy Council's Ukrainian PRISM think tank. We reached her in Odessa, Ukraine. Ms. Shelest, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
At an Oval Office event last month, President Trump mused that he'd like to restore the old name for the Department of Defense, the Department of War. Trump said it, quote, just sounded better. That wasn't the first time he's talked about a name change for the Defense Department. Now, a White House official has confirmed with NPR that Trump will sign an executive order today on the rebranding, designating the Department of War as a secondary title for the department. The official was not authorized to discuss the order on record. NPR's Quill Lawrence has all the details.
George Washington was president when the U.S. government created the War Department to oversee the U.S. military. Then, after World War II, President Harry S. Truman changed the name to the Department of Defense, housed in the newly finished Pentagon building in Virginia. The name was less antagonistic as the world's superpowers tried to avoid mutual destruction in a nuclear war for the next several decades. Trump mentioned he'd like to change the name back in an Oval Office meeting last month.
You know, it didn't sound good. Defense, what are we defense? Why are we defense? So it used to be called the Department of War, and it had a stronger sound. And as you know, we won World War I, we won World War II, we won everything. Now we have a Department of Defense with defenders. I don't know. If you people want to, standing behind me, if you take a little vote, if you want to change it back to what it was when we used to win wars all the time, that's okay with me. All right?
That's coming
you
soon, sir.
You let me know if you want to do it.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth can be heard saying the name change was coming. As the largest department in the U.S. government, even just changing signs, seals, and titles could cost tens of millions of dollars. It cost the Biden administration about $39 million to change the names of 9 Army bases that previously honored Confederate generals. The Trump administration has changed those names back, finding other U.S. military honorees who happen to have the same surnames as Confederate generals like Lee, Pickett, and Hill. It's not clear Trump can officially change the name to the Department of War without congressional action, but the president has said he would do so regardless. He can, however, immediately start using the name in White House communications. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Join us Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids River Fest. I'm Jennifer Barr, and I am so excited for this year's lineup. Music starts at 3 o'clock with Alan Sparhawk, a prolific and versatile musician best known as the frontman of Low. His many side projects over the years reveal a musician unafraid to experiment. Then we'll hear Jeremy Albino. His songs are grounded in the gritty storytelling of classic country music propelled by the rhythms of old school R&B. And then Margot Price. She has something to say but nothing to prove, and in just a few solo albums she has cemented herself as a force in Americana music. We'll end our night with Courtney Barnett, one of Australia's most successful musical exports. She has played many festivals around the world, including Coachella, Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and now Grand Rapids River Fest. Find tickets and more info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. See you September 6th.
NPR comes from this station and from Dickinson College, awarding the Rose Walters Prize for Global Environmental Activism to combat climate change and inspire future leaders. Learn more at dickinson.edu/RWP. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The biggest names in tech dined with President Trump at the White House last night. The event provided a photo op showing harmony between Washington and Silicon Valley. But NPR's Bobby Allen tells us behind the scenes it's a different story, dominated by the Trump administration's aggressive actions against tech in federal courts. Bobby covers technology, and he's with us now. Bobby, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so starting off, who went to this event and what happened?
So as the tech industry's top CEOs, that includes Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, Apple's Tim Cook, Google's Sundar Pichai, and OpenAI's Sam Altman, and dozens of others, many of them, you might remember, were at the Capitol for Trump's inauguration in January. And that was seen back then as Silicon Valley coming together and showing support for Trump. Last night, they were back together for a dinner at the White House, and that followed a meeting on AI, on education and AI. First Lady Melania Trump is chairing a task force on that subject. The one conspicuous absence was Elon Musk. As we know, he formerly was a White House advisor, but had a big falling out with Trump, and Musk claimed on X that he was invited to the White House dinner, but that he unfortunately could not make it.
So situate this dinner for us. I mean, people may remember that the relationship between Silicon Valley and the White House during Trump's first term was strained. So what about now?
Yeah, well, there's what some might call the kissing the ring optics, right? Tech executives, you know, promising new U.S. investments, dropping diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. But what's happening under the surface, Michelle, is really interesting because it doesn't match what's happening on the surface at all. In federal courtrooms across the country, the Trump administration's lawyers are pursuing really sweeping antitrust cases against Apple, against Amazon, against Meta, against Google. In fact, after a federal judge handed Google a victory recently and would not break up the company, one of Trump's top Department of Justice officials said they are not done fighting Google to rein in its power.
Okay, but how tough is the White House really being on tech? I mean, aren't there former Silicon Valley executives in the administration helping to steer things?
Yeah, there are. The White House isn't pushing Congress, say, to, you know, pass tough regulations on AI or crypto. That is something of a win and a bit of a reversal from the Biden administration, which really put the focus on AI safety and consumer protection. But again, if you look at federal courts, it's a whole other story.
So, Bobby, before we let you go, is there any indication the administration will pause or drop any of its cases against these tech companies, which it has done in other regulatory areas, especially cases that started by the previous administration in the environmental area, for example, or maybe consumer protection?
When it comes to these tech cases, there's no indication that the administration's planning to back off any of these. Now, if Trump wanted to, he could, right? He could instruct his administration to drop all of them, but he's not doing that. And it's worth noting that these government lawsuits, Michelle, cost millions of dollars to defend against. They take years to resolve. They're just a huge headache for tech companies. Some of them are even calling for tech companies to be broken up so they could be consequential. Now, if Trump gets annoyed with Silicon Valley for some reason, he could have his administration launch even more lawsuits and investigations into them. So that's something these executives may have been thinking about at the dinner last night.
That's NPR's Bobby Allen. Bobby, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Time now for StoryCorps. This week, we hear from their Brightness in Black project and a story from the Motor City. Emmeline King was the first Black woman to design cars for Ford. It was a passion she inherited from her father, Ernest, who also worked at Ford. Ernest brought designs to life, making the fiberglass molds that became cars. Emmeline told her sister-in-law the story of the first time he brought her to work.
Dad took me to the company Christmas party. We came to a blue door, and the closer I got to it, I smelled clay. Dad told me behind those doors are men, and they are car designers. And the clay that you smell is the cars that they make. And after I left there, I said, I'm going to be a car designer designing cars with you, Dad. And so I began drawing cars. I was only 11.
And you wasn't good at first. But you never quit.
And when I was hired, my desk was behind the blue doors. The first car that I designed was the 89 Thunderbird. And I saw the car on the road. I was so excited. I was yelling out, hey, lady, I designed the car you're riding. I was able to design the 1994 Mustang. And one day at work, Dad had the biggest smile on his face. And one of his coworkers, they said, Ernie, what are you working on? And he said, I'm working on my daughter's design. Several years later, Ford had to do downsizing and I was let go. I waited a good 2 to 3 weeks before I got enough nerve to tell my father. He said, Emmeline, everyone will see that this Black girl out of Detroit, the Motor City, was able to have her place in history. You know, we were in competition, collecting model cars. And after Dad had passed, I came across this big box. Dad had ordered about 20 of the Mustang Mach 3, the car that I designed. Dad taught me to never let anyone tell you what you can't become because you are a girl. I feel in my heart he is proud of his little girl, and he opened that door.
That was Emmeline King and her sister-in-law, Michelle Williams King, for StoryCorps. In 2024, King received the Presidential Lifetime Achievement Award for her groundbreaking career, and their conversation is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. And from Dignity Memorial, for many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
Two ships lost over a century ago have been found at the bottom of the Great Lakes. They're just two in a record number of shipwrecks that have been found in the region in recent years.
They sometimes have the most interesting and rich histories. Each one of these shipwrecks is really a time capsule.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Why more and more of these time capsules are being found nowadays on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered. It's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE. It's 5:30. early morning here on Grand Rapids Riverfest Eve. People are assembling. They're getting excited. The stage is going to be going up. So many things happening. Have you gotten your ticket yet? It is tomorrow. Doors, gates open at 2 and first concert at 3 with Alan Sparhawk. Find out more information at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. We receive support from Lake Country Journal, their lifestyle magazine, since 1997. A local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, the things to do, and the people to know in Lake Country. Music now from a performer from 2 years ago for the Grand Rapids River Fest. A nice morning song to get us off to our start, along with John Latimer's Nature Note. Stay tuned.
Step outside in the middle of the morning and in the evening again. Yes, I've tried to be grateful for my devils and call them by their names, but I'm
on today's date, September 5th, in the year 2000, I noticed that the round-leaf dogwood berries are becoming ripe. These berries sit atop of the round-leaf dogwoods on these red cymes. These are the structures that supported the flowers and are now supporting the berries. You'll notice there are far fewer berries than there were flowers last spring, and that's because the plant has many sterile flowers among that big disc of white flowers that you see every spring. But now, in the fall, you're seeing berries that are kind of a skim milk blue and can get even more intensely blue to almost what I would call sky blue. The berries become quite lovely atop those red structures. And as you're looking at those berries, look at the leaves of the plant and notice how they are starting to turn burgundy. And when all is said and done, if the bears haven't eaten these berries, which are among their favorite fall foods, there will be a beautiful burgundy bush topped with these bluish white berries.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Was a U.S. strike on a boat in the Caribbean, which President Trump said killed 11 Venezuelan narco-terrorists, legal? In other words, was it consistent with international and maritime law? On Tuesday, the president announced that U.S. forces had destroyed the vessel and shared footage of the strike on Truth Social. The administration says the boat was in international waters. But beyond this, the administration has not provided evidence to support his claims about what the boat and the people on it were up to. We've called Brian Finucane to talk more about this. He's a national security lawyer with the International Crisis Group, which is an organization focused on conflict resolution. Good morning, Mr. Finucane. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
First, I'd just like to ask broadly when a president has legal authority to use this kind of military force, as briefly as you can.
Well, in this situation, Congress, which has the bulk of the war powers in the Constitution, did not authorize the operation. The White House would have to therefore rely solely on Article 2 of the Constitution, but it has not explained how the Constitution authorizes this attack earlier this week.
What legal issues does this raise for you as a person with expertise in this area?
Well, when you see the premeditated killing of another person outside of an armed conflict, there's a term for that, and that term is murder. The administration has not established that the United States is in an armed conflict with Trinidad, Aragua, or any other criminal entity in Latin America, has not established that this operation is governed by the law of war, and has not established that the targets of this operation, whether the passengers on the boat or the cargo of the boat, were lawful targets under the law of war.
So you mentioned Trinidad, Aragua. You said that because the president has labeled the Trinidad, Aragua gang as a foreign terrorist organization. He says that they were behind this boat and whatever it was doing. Let's just say for the sake of argument that that's true. Does that give him latitude to use force on a boat like this?
No. Designating India as a foreign terrorist organization neither confers authority under U.S. law to use military force, nor does it magically transfer or transform that entity into a lawful military target.
So let's say that for the sake of argument that this boat was transporting substances that would be illegal in the United States, let's say an illegal drug, or so illegal for consumer use or whatever it was. So is the trafficking of an illegal consumer product a capital offense? Would that justify military force?
No. That's why we have law enforcement, and that's why we have well-established procedures for the Coast Guard and the Navy to conduct maritime interdiction operations, take people into custody, and prosecute them through the criminal justice system as appropriate. This is not an appropriate use of lethal military force in the first instance. The administration is trying to frame its confrontation with criminal entities in Latin America as a new war on terror, but that's a completely inappropriate use of that both rhetorical framework and, more importantly, the legal frameworks used for lethal force.
So the administration argues that the people on this boat were endangering American lives by bringing this substance here or possibly engaging in some other activities. Does that, in your view, justify this action?
Just to reiterate, they have made allegations, but they have not provided any information to substantiate these claims. But even if they did, it would not provide a sufficient basis for the use of lethal force in the first instance.
That is Brian Finucane. He's a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group, and he's a national security lawyer. Mr. Finucane, thanks so much for sharing these insights with us.
Thank you.
President Trump has a pattern of giving people in his administration several big jobs at the same time. It's something he did a little of in his first term, but it's off the charts now. NPR's senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports on all the Trump officials wearing more than one hat.
When it was Secretary of State Marco Rubio's turn to speak during President Trump's recent marathon cabinet meeting, he joked about his employment status.
For me personally, this is the most meaningful Labor Day of my life as someone with four jobs. And so it's true.
Rubio is currently serving as Secretary of State, acting National Security Advisor, and acting Archivist of the United States. He recently handed off his fourth job, acting Director of the U.S. Agency for International Development, to another administration official who already had two other jobs himself.
I mean, honestly, all of these are more than full-time jobs.
Alexander Gray was chief of staff for the National Security Council in the first Trump administration. He says Rubio is succeeding by prioritizing Trump's foreign policy instincts.
If you don't have delusions of grandeur about what the job is supposed to do, if you don't think you're a policymaker, you can do the job very effectively even while doing other things.
Rubio became acting national security advisor 4 months ago, and there's no indication that is changing anytime soon. White House spokesperson Anna Kelly tells NPR that having officials serve in multiple roles allows for greater communication and collaboration in the administration. The positive results speak for themselves, she added. Max Steyer leads the Partnership for Public Service, which exists to promote best practices in government.
This is no way to run anything, and certainly not a way to run our government.
So, yeah, Steyer is beside himself with all the Trump administration's double-hatting. Using a basketball analogy, he says this is like asking
a single player to be able to play your center and your point guard on your basketball team at the same time.
The other cabinet official with as many jobs as Rubio is Russell Vogt. He is Senate confirmed as the director of the Office of Management and Budget and has been acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau since February. Steyer says in that case, Vogt's multiple hats make sense.
He actively wants to dismantle it. And so that puts his hand on the tiller to make sure that he can run it into the rocks. And so there, I think it says a lot about what they think about our government.
Vogt also became acting director of USAID last week with the express purpose of closing it down. There are now at least a dozen administration officials serving in two jobs or more. Trump is totally within the bounds of the law with these assignments, but his approach makes him an outlier among presidents. Alexander Gray, who served in the first term, says this is just Trump's management style, honed over a lifetime of running the Trump Organization.
And in a family business like the Trump Organization, people wear multiple hats. First term, people wear multiple hats. Now, it's I think, turbocharged this time, but that's his comfort level, is you find people he's comfortable with, who he thinks do a great job, and you just keep giving them more responsibility.
Case in point, Richard Grenell, Trump's special missions envoy, who now also runs the Kennedy Center. Then there's the Treasury Secretary / acting IRS Commissioner, the Health and Human Services Deputy Secretary, temporarily in charge of the CDC, and the Transportation Secretary, who now also leads NASA. In his spare time, Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 5:42. Thanks for tuning in. It's the Friday morning show on People Powered KAXE. This message is paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988, support that meets you where you are. It's confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. A lot coming up for you on the Friday morning show, including our talkback segment. We are also going to be talking about Riverfest, sports, the Lynx last night, the opening of NFL, so much going on for the sports page. And then Katie Marshall in for a conversation about tonight's First Friday events in downtown Grand Rapids. It is kind of a Grand Rapids Riverfest weekend. So many events going on. You're going to want to stay tuned. We'd like to thank the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids for their support, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8. Information about this summer's Martini Monday music series available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Weather around our region, we're expecting cloudy skies, highs in the mid to upper 50s today, but breezy northwest winds and evening temperatures in the low 40s. Tomorrow, Riverfest Day, partly sunny, highs in the upper 50s to low 60s.
Now's your chance to see one of the most acclaimed indie rock artists of the past 20 years at Grand Rapids Riverfest, going on Saturday, September 6th. In addition to Courtney Barnett, you'll get to see Alan Sparhawk, Jeremy Albino, and Margo Price.
Don't let the bastards get you down. Don't say Christmas tree.
You can get your tickets for Grand Rapids Riverfest at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. You won't want to miss one of the biggest concert nights in northern Minnesota this year.
PR comes from this station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at BetterHelp.com/public. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. One of the world's most famous brands is getting a new slogan. Nike is turning its nearly 40-year-old tagline, "Just do it," into a question. Why do it?
Why chance it? Why put it on the line? With so much at stake. With so much room to fail. Why risk it?
The company says greatness is a choice and that its new slogan is aimed at connecting with younger athletes. So will it succeed? Let's ask Brittany Kiefer. She's a creative editor with the publication Adweek and has been tracking Nike's recent race to remain relevant. Brittany, greatness is a is a choice. Okay. You spoke with the company about the bet they're making with this rebrand. What are they saying?
Yeah, so Just Do It, like you said, it's been around since 1988, and it's shown up in different cultural contexts with different people, both ordinary humans and legendary athletes. But this time, Nike's speaking to young people, and they say that this generation is afraid of failure, and in some cases, they're afraid to even try. So that's why they need to subvert their logo, their slogan, which isn't going away completely, but asking young people why even do it in the first place.
So it used to be like when I, you know, put on a new pair of shoes, a new pair of sneakers, it'd be like, I want to go out and conquer the world. Now the sneakers are just to get you out of bed.
Yeah, basically, just take that first step and that can lead to greatness.
Yeah. So Just Do It, I know it came out in 1988. That's like kind of Gen Xers coming out of age territory right there. And I'll admit it kind of speaks to this no-nonsense, get over yourself attitude. What does Why Do It tap into, you think?
Well, as the Nike CMO, Nicole Graham, told me, it's kind of giving voice to a doubt that a lot of young people feel about whether they should even try to achieve anything. And really, it's about redefining those three words for young people who may not get its relevance and its power in the same way as previous generations.
Why try to achieve anything? I got to admit, Brittany, this is kind of making me a little worried. These are the people that are going to be taking care of me when, you know, I'm 70 or 80 years old.
Yeah, they are. They've been dubbed the anxious generation. But really, I think what Nike isn't saying explicitly is that they are obsessed with trying to remain relevant and get young people to believe in their legacy in the same way that older people may, like yourself, may still believe in it.
So how do you think it's played so far, this Why Do It slogan?
I've seen mixed reactions on social media. Some people are kind of pointing out that it alludes to a bit of weakness, I guess, a lack of confidence. And other people found the ad really powerful. It has a lot of new generation athletes in it. And each of them, instead of showing them in their moment of glory, it's showing them in that moment where they decide to take a risk.
How will Nike know if this is working?
Well, Nike's been in the middle of this brand turnaround and this race to kind of remain relevant. So they've revamped their strategy, and what's really going to show if it's working is in the numbers. They're a big ship to turn around, so we may not see a jump in sales immediately, but ultimately what will pay off is, are the cool kids on the street corner wearing Nike? Are they talking about Nike on social media? And that's how we'll know if it's worked.
Brittany Kiefer is a creative editor at Adweek. Brittany, thanks.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
up September 6th, we are so excited for Grand Rapids River Fest. Opening up will be Alan Sparhawk, who recently talked with Kari Hedlund about his new album with Trampled by Turtles.
I remember at the time going like, man, I can't tell if this is any good. I'm questioning myself a lot here, but I don't know. There was a little bit of obligation, I think, because those guys had made room for me, put their trust in me, so to speak. I kind of had to tell myself, you know, I just need to push through and just sing, do the best I can and trust that I'm in the hands of good people. I feel like I did. I found my voice. Thank you for thinking of me, and I'm glad to be there. Mim and I grew up out past Bemidji, so I'm looking forward to it.
Grand Rapids River Fest with Alan Sparhawk opening up, then Jeremy Albino, Margot Price, and Courtney Barnett. Get your tickets at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Turn up the prod.
US and Japan have a trade deal. For real this time.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance offers personalized rates and customizable coverages for your business vehicles. More at progressivecommercial.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishor, in for David Brancaccio. The US and Japan have finalized their trade deal a month and a half after it was announced. President Trump signed an executive order putting it into force and ending a tariff roller coaster. Tariffs on some Japanese cars, for example, went from 2.5% up to 27.5% in April. Now they're back down to 15%. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
The White House says there will now be a 15% baseline tariff on almost all Japanese imports. The agreement cuts tariffs on Japanese cars almost in half. The flat import tax will not be stacked on top of existing levies, so the tariff on Japanese products like cars and beef will be adjusted down to 15%. Japanese imports that were subject to a lower import tax will be adjusted up to 15%. The executive order says Tokyo is working toward a 75% increase in purchases of U.S. rice and promises to buy $8 billion worth of U.S. soybeans, corn, and other agricultural products per year. Japan also says it'll buy American planes and weapons, and Tokyo agreed to invest $550 billion in projects chosen by the Trump administration. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Remember, no taxes on tips? It was a campaign promise and then made it into the GOP's tax and spending law. Well, we now know, mostly, which jobs this would apply to. The Treasury Department released a list of them. The deduction is only supposed to go to people in jobs that traditionally got tips before the law passed, so a lot of jobs you would expect are on there. But as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, so are a few surprises.
Waiters, taxi drivers, and hairstylists are among the 68 occupations on the list. Many of them already track their tips as part of their wages. But what about for plumbers and electricians? Alex Morishanu is with the Tax Foundation.
The IRS has criteria for what counts as a tip generally, but for some of these occupations, there will need to be more guidance on how eligibility will work.
Digital content creators, also on the list, is getting a reward or a gift during a live stream, a tip. Even if folks are eligible, according to Joseph Rosenberg at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
Our estimates are that, you know, roughly about 3% of taxpayers are likely to benefit from that deduction.
Most workers take the standard deduction anyway, so no tax on tips won't exactly translate into a big difference come tax time. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All eyes are on the jobs report coming out later this morning. It's going to tell us how many jobs the U.S. added, and it'll affect interest rate policy. We'll have live coverage. With that, let's do the numbers. Dow futures are down just 18 points, almost nothing. S&P futures are up 0.2%. NASDAQ futures up 0.5%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.16%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance. From filing returns to tracking assessments, Avalara can help. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
A study published in the journal Nature last year estimated disruptions caused by warming temperatures could cost $38 trillion a year across the globe by the middle of this century. Marketplace's Amy Scott with our How We Survive team has been reporting on the ways climate change is already showing up in the economy. Hi, Amy.
Good morning.
How is climate change showing up in our economy?
Well, of course, you know, there's the direct cost of disaster. As anyone who has experienced recently the flooding in Texas or New Jersey or, you know, the devastating wildfires in Southern California knows, recovery is very expensive. The Trump administration has actually stopped tracking extreme weather events that cause more than $1 billion in damage. But last year, there were 27 such events, including drought, wildfires, winter storms, tropical cyclones. And the administration has also cut federal funding for climate mitigation, which is shown to actually save money in the long run. It is cheaper to prevent damage than to repair it later.
So there's the cost of, you know, fixing all the stuff that climate change related storms break. But then there've got to be indirect costs. And I'm thinking of insurance, which has been rising. Has that stabilized at all?
Yeah. So unfortunately, premiums are expected to keep rising on average 8% this year for homeowner insurance policies. That's according to Insurify. And that's after a 20% increase the past 2 years. And of course, some places will see much higher increases, like California is projected to see more than 20% increases. And as I'm sure you know, Sabri, this isn't just from climate disasters, but also the higher building costs we've been seeing because of inflation and now tariffs and just more people living in harm's way. And experts say that that is going to increasingly show up in the housing market as whole neighborhoods just get harder and more expensive to insure.
Yeah. Speaking of inflation, I mean, does climate change play a role in other kinds of inflation? I'm thinking food.
Yep. You've probably noticed higher coffee prices or chocolate prices. Oranges have gone up in price. And some of that is attributed to climate change because of the effects of warming temperatures or drought or flooding or storms on these crops. The Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Studies and the European Central Bank recently found that climate change could increase food inflation overall by more than 3 percentage points per year. And that would lead to higher inflation as well of, you know, more than 1% per year by 2035. And all this is making some staples in people's diets seem more like luxuries. The upcoming season of our podcast, How We Survive, is actually all about the future of food. And we'll be looking at some solutions that launches in October.
I will be looking forward to hearing it. All right, Marketplace's Amy Scott, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sabri.
Amy and Marketplace host Kai Ryssdal are hosting a live webinar on September 9th with science writer Elizabeth Colbert. You can sign up to attend at marketplace.org/climate. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
We've been listening to Morning Edition from National Public Radio. It's here on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. People-powered radio in northern Minnesota, you can join us at KAXE.org. The Tally Gallery at Bemidji State University has a new retrospective exhibit of work by Marley Call. Last night was the opening reception, but it will be on display through October 30th. Headwaters chapter of Let's Go Fishing has a meatball dinner today from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Park Rapids American Legion. Proceeds go toward the operation of their community pontoon, which provides fishing outings for seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities. Going on tomorrow, the Virginia Area Historical Society's annual Fall Fest.